to the Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. Typically, we talk to folks from all sorts of backgrounds and industries about money, mental health, relationships, the creative process itself, and more. For this season, we're trying something a little bit new and experimenting with theme seasons. And for this one, we're focusing on music, bands, artists, and industry folks. Big thanks to Desert Days Music Fest for helping make a lot of these interviews happen. Visit desertdays.org to check them out and to grab your tickets for the fest in the fall of this year. Also, thank you to Ton Starts Bandit for providing their song Wet Ass Morning as our intro and outro music, and to Hannah Spencer for doing all of our branding and design work. Hope you dig it. Hello. This week's episode is with Jeffrey Silverstein, who is a musician, writer, educator, and a buddy of mine. He just released his first solo EP titled How on Earth on Driftless Recordings, which you can go buy on cassette or digital download and stream wherever you stream music. He's also played in the band Secret Mountains and Nassau, he's in Portland now, but both those were over on the East Coast, among others. As a writer, he's contributed to Bandcamp Daily, Reverb, Vinyl Me Please, Aquarium Drunkard, Smith Journal, and a bunch more. He also co-founded a 7-inch vinyl subscription service, I guess, called Singles Club, and is a full-time teacher. Yeah. Before I forget, he is playing some shows in the Pacific Northwest, in Portland. Let me look. In Portland and Seattle. In Portland on March 23rd, and Seattle May 3rd, and then Portland again on May 4th. Check out his website, jeffreylewissilverstein.com, for those dates. I'll put them in the show notes at theprocess.co as well. Yeah, so in this episode, we talk a lot about how Jeffrey balances a full-time job with his creative work and how they play into and, I guess, serve each other. He also wrote this really incredible guide, which I linked to in the show notes, on The Creative Independent about that exact topic. We talk about that quite a bit. What the process has been like to go solo, to record and perform solo, how he's come to really get to know his passions and stick to them. We also cover how challenging his own beliefs about him has helped him say no to distractions, which has been a big part of the whole being able to work full-time and do all this stuff on the side, learning how to collaborate, the journey of finding a musical style that feels right to him as an artist. We talk about Ted Lucas, who's an incredible guitarist and musician and songwriter, the value of sharing your art with at least one other person, why he signed to a label, and how regular exercise has changed his life, and a bunch more. Again, he's a bud, so this is truly a conversation. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you do too. Sweet. We have 3 episodes left of this season. Next week, I think, is with Amanda Guest of BFF.FM, a community radio station here in San Francisco, and then with the band Beak out of Bristol, and then finishing up with Rick McGuire from Pile. So if you haven't already subscribed, hit subscribe so you'll be notified when those go live. If you like it, rate, review, please. We appreciate it. It really helps us out. I think that's it. I'll catch y'all next week.
My name is Jeffrey Silverstein. I am a teacher, a writer, and a musician living in Portland, Oregon. And I somewhat successfully have managed to find a balance between those kind of 3 things. Yeah.
I wasn't going to dive right into the article, but fuck it. Let's dive right into the article.
Yeah.
For The Creative Independent, which we were just talking about.
Yeah.
That went viral. For those who haven't read it, and mm-hmm. I'll obviously link to it in the show notes, mm-hmm. but for those who haven't read it, give us the rundown of how you do manage all 3 of those things, and then we'll kind of work backwards.
Yeah. So the article was really, on their site, they have what's called guides, and the guide that we created along with my wife, Sunny, who did all the illustrations, was kind of a guide for balancing full-time work with creative endeavors, which I have certainly never been somebody that can only be kind of grounded in one aspect of my work. I feel like having other outlets is something that kind of helps push me forward in kind of everything that I'm doing. So I kind of just walked the article. I kind of just walked people through kind of my approach to doing that. And some of it kind of, focuses on making sure that you are like being kind to yourself. Part of it focuses on just making sure like kind of ways to find the right day job for you, so that you do have that kind of extra energy or strength to go and do the creative work. Outside of that, you know, the other thing that I really focused on in there was just kind of the importance of kind of leaning on your like immediate community and not being someone that just kind of like turns inward, you know, all the time. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird to be 31 and feel like I feel like to some degree I've amassed some kind of like wisdom, you know, in these areas. And I really enjoy sharing how I go about doing that. And I was like, honestly, so blown away that anyone took anything from that article. It was like, you know, I've interviewed so many musicians like over the years, and this was like, you know, what was so nice is writing more from like a personal perspective. Like people from all over like sent me personal notes on, you know, social media or email, just saying how much they resonated with them. And that like really struck a nerve with me. I was like, oh, like I do have something kind of like to offer and to share with people that, you know, and this is why I want to share it.
Yeah.
So that was really cool.
Yeah, because you tried to do going back quite a ways in New York. You were working for a music media company.
Yeah.
You worked for MTV, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So was that your attempt to like try to have a job in the music industry or not?
Yeah. So I've only ever worked in music or education. I've said it for quite some time now. Those are clearly like two of my biggest, you know, kind of passion areas. My first experience out of college, I worked for a music venue called Sonar that like people in Baltimore will definitely know of. It was like this crazy 3-room venue, and I was just so excited to be around musicians and promoting shows. And that was also when I was starting to like write my own music and be involved in like the Baltimore kind of music scene there, which is like the first time I really felt a part of a music community was in Baltimore. Eventually, the owner of that venue was running like a multi-million dollar marijuana smuggling operation, which I kind of like was aware of, but maybe not to what degree.
Yeah.
Anyway, things got like very strange very quickly there. I remember the guy was booking, like paying like hundreds of thousands of dollars to have like the Mars Volta play or something, yeah. but then not being able to pay them because we like didn't have the money. Anyway, but yeah, so that was kind of like my first real music job. Then I was teaching for a little while in Baltimore at like a really rough school.
What you went to school for, education?
I went to school for journalism at Towson University right outside of Baltimore. So I was just really lucky that I kind of like didn't do the go home thing first. You know, I just kind of stayed in Baltimore, and I feel like that was one of the smartest things I ever did for myself, was like not go back to New Jersey.
Okay.
Right after college. But yeah, taught in Baltimore. And then, yeah, when I moved to New York, I worked at a summer camp through the 92nd Street Y. I was doing after school gigs. I was working at a baby clothes store that my friend ran, you know, for a minute, just odds and ends. And then I kind of was put in the somewhat of a predicament of either taking this job at MTV or going and doing what was called the New York City Teaching Fellows, which I would later actually go on to do. But I was like accepted to that program, but at that point in time I was like really still obsessed with the idea of like working in music. So I took this job at MTV, and it was really cool at first. And you know, I thought, what could be better? I'm in New York and I have this like music office job that's allowing me to like stay, you know, in New York and at least get by, or at least like pay my crazy rent.
Yeah.
And
they notoriously, maybe it might have been before your day, but yeah, I was like reading an interview with someone recently who worked at MTV mm-hmm. forever ago, and they like might have not named it, but that's what they're talking about. And they like didn't pay their people shit.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was your case or...
So basically they keep people on like permalance like for forever. So I was really an hourly employee, and I had to like have my own, you know, health insurance and whatever else. And
were you writing for them? What were you doing for them?
I was like working on the project that they had called MTV Artists, which was their attempt at like a MySpace or a Facebook, like a platform of sorts, but it never really had any legs. And I was just kind of like first line of defense if anything ever went wrong for any of these pages, which meant that like someone in like the middle of nowhere in America that was like making like new metal could write basically directly to me to be like, my page isn't working. And I would have to like be like, oh, I'm so sorry that you can't upload your new metal track.
Yeah.
Like, and then I was getting so bored there. But the biggest thing that happened there is that like literally while I was pretty much still on the clock, I started writing for other places for free. And then for a brief moment in time, MTV had a site that I actually still think was fantastic to this day called MTV Hive. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like their indie site for a while. It was run by really amazing editors and writers who would then go on to GQ and The Fader. And I always remember being like, how come I'm not on that team? Yeah. Like, I'm working on the Lane project. The people sitting right next to me are involved in the stuff I really want to get into. Eventually, they let me kind of, MTV Hive let me do this column where I was curating mixtapes. So I was getting other kind of like the grandfather blog era.
Yeah.
I was getting friends of mine who ran other music sites that I really admired to like curate mixes and start interviewing. You know, I remember I interviewed like Mike, who runs Captured Tracks in Brooklyn. That was like the first time I interviewed Kevin Morby. So all of a sudden, I was kind of having the opportunity to like be in that pocket for my writing of stuff I really wanted to be in. So I was writing probably when I should have been doing other work, yeah. You know, at that job, but I really didn't
answer
care.
Answering angry emails.
Yeah.
Their metal track.
Yeah. So like, oh my God. And like, there's still, thinking back on like some of the artists I had to like help, like, I mean, I fully support anyone trying to make music, but like, I would go to some of these pages and I was just like, you have to be kidding me. This is like a real thing. So I was writing a bunch, mostly for free, just to try to like compile as many kind of clips as I could. But then still like, oh my God, but like my actual job is still so unfulfilling.
Yeah.
you know, like when I didn't have something to write on. And at that point in time, the band that I was in for a really long time had kind of ended, so I was just feeling like a bit lost.
Kind of, and like, what type of music were you making before I met you?
Yeah, so I was in a like a psych rock band called Secret Mountains, and that was a project that I started in Baltimore with the vocalist Kelly Laughlin, and it was like just me and her for a while playing shows, and then eventually it became this kind of six person band, and did a bunch of touring, and that lasted for, I mean, ultimately in different forms, was probably around for 5 or 6 years.
Ever making any money, like as a band, or break even?
Yeah, there was like we were like at a point where we like definitely had some really serious momentum, and like we're getting like nice reviews, and like got written about in the New York Times, and then basically like right after we put out our full length like on vinyl, and it was like the biggest deal in the world to all of us.
Yeah.
Like our the band kind of just ended.
Okay.
Very quickly, and that was really hard for me, and I like was just such a baby about it for such a long time. And I think that that's kind of what I like wrote about in the article, going back to that too, was just that like I was like kind of like feeling like upset about that, and then my job was so unfulfilling, and I feel like having the unfulfilling day job really left in that kind of state of like, well, who cares if I write something today? Who cares if I go on a run today or write a song today? It just added to this general feeling of bleh. Yeah.
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 I know that feeling.
So again, I was writing while I was there. That wasn't really doing it for me, or at least not enough. And I wasn't getting paid at that point to write anything, but just really good experience. Eventually, I realized that I really missed working with kids. And so I reapplied to that same program that I initially got into and was accepted into that fellows program. So then the last 2 years of living in New York, I was playing a band, going to school, and teaching full-time, and trying to still write and all that stuff. So, yeah.
And you were teaching children with special needs, right? Is that like the correct
terminology? Yeah. I was going to Hunter College for my master's in special education. That program really tries to, when you are kind of going through your training, place you in schools that are like, they call them like high need schools. So like underprivileged kids, kids with learning disabilities, so on and so forth. I just really lucked out because I got placed at a school called Brooklyn Frontiers, which was considered an alternative high school, which basically meant that the ninth graders who entered that school had been held back.
Okay.
Two or more times. So they're a little bit older, but what I really loved about that is like instead of them getting held back and then feeling like the older or bigger student, like and kind of feeling like the dumb kid,
yeah.
They got to kind of be put on a level playing field with other kids who had that kind of similar experience. Yeah, these kids had, you know, different learning disabilities. Majority of them came from families that had, you know, experienced some kind of trauma to various degrees. And a lot of them just had, because of that trauma, had a lot of difficulty regulating their own emotions. And I really feel like that piece just can block so much learning. Yeah. Like, if you can't kind of access that certain parts of yourself. And I just watched so many of them struggle with that all day long. And I think then most of the days, you know, getting through a lesson was amazing. You know, it felt so good if you could actually get through like one academic thing. But for the most part, I kind of realized that like just having these kids like be in, you know, like a safe, rewarding, comfortable environment, even just for part of their day was really great. And I don't necessarily know if all of them had that once they like left the building.
Yeah.
For the rest of the day. So I loved that school. It was really hard for me to leave in regards to schools I potentially could have been placed at. Like, I just learned so much, and it was such a wonderfully diverse staff. I don't know. That was definitely what solidified me wanting to continue being a teacher, was having that experience. Yeah.
So I know a few musicians mm-hmm. who are either teachers or becoming mm-hmm. teachers. And I think all the people I know are, like, generally, like you are passionate about education, mm-hmm. but you also hear of your people who become a teacher because they want the summers off, whether like including those who aren't musicians, people who whatever, for whatever reason the schedule is appealing, but you're not one of those people. You do it because you actually
passionate about it. Yeah, and I feel really lucky to like and grateful even to be able to say that like I want to continue down the path, because I mean so many people dive into it and then also are put into like, you know, the most demanding environments you could ever imagine right off the bat, and are so wildly under prepared for that it just becomes this like grueling thing. And that's even before you start opening up the conversation about pay and benefits and all of that. And all of a sudden, yeah, you've got people who teach for 6 months and are like, that's it for me. Like, there's no way. It's not, you know, it's not sustainable. So I feel really lucky that I think I've found ways to make teaching sustainable for myself. And I think, again, going back to the article, though, I think part of it being sustainable was me having these other outlets like music and writing in my life that I could kind of release to and find other sources of fulfillment. Because I just really think I find it scary when teachers are only fulfilled from that. And I'm also like a pretty big believer in that. It doesn't have to be a requirement, but I do think that part of being a good teacher, not always, is having other lived experiences that you can then bring into the classroom instead of having just gone down the traditional path of like, I went to school for this, now I am this. Because I think you kind of just lock into like what you were told in whatever program you did was accurate, and then you do that instead of like, oh, but what about what I learned from traveling? What about what I learned from that other culture? It was funny when I got to that school in Brooklyn that I loved, when you tell them that you're part of like the New York City Teaching Fellows, which teaches you all of these really corny like phrases and even like movements to do as a teacher, like how you're supposed to like position your body when you're questioning kids. And like, they all were just like, yeah, you need to like leave that, you know, at the door. Like, they were like, bring yourself, bring, you know, what you do, your passion for music and all of this other stuff.
And they can see right through
so quick.
Anything. So much better than adults.
Yeah.
Like, and they don't give a fuck. They'll tell you.
Yeah. And I kind of love that. So again, I just feel super lucky that I've kind of been able to figure out a way to sustain it and tie that into my other creative outlets as well. And like, cause it does feel like right now they all kind of support each other in a really nice way, and kind of like, because of this, I don't know, whatever, you know, triangle of music, writing and teaching, you want to kind of envision, like, it feels like they keep like just bouncing off each other and leading to new opportunities. And that's really all I can kind of hope for. So
yeah. Kind of go with the flow.
Yeah.
I remember last time I interviewed you, I think I asked like if you could do this be music
mm-hmm.
full time, mm-hmm. would you? And I'm pretty sure the answer was yes. It's been a while since we had the conversation. Do you remember if you said that? And if so, do you still feel
I think maybe, so that was definitely still in New York, so I probably was still teaching at the school in Brooklyn, maybe, or maybe I was done with that, maybe it was summertime, so I was getting ready to move, maybe.
I don't even know if you had your master's yet.
Oh.
You might have had your master's.
I mean, honestly, I think I am, as I have grown to love teaching as much as I do, the degree to which I maybe desire to, like, you know, be on the road for however many days out of the year and do that, I think lessens over time. However, every time I play a show, I am reminded of how invigorating that can be for someone's, like, spirit. And then, you know, for the next, like, 3 days, you know, after that, I'm, like, obsessed with, like, how can I have that again?
Yeah.
Right? Which I think is pretty normal for someone that, you know, like, plays music and wants to, you know, get out there and share it with other people. So I think since I'm working on all of the solo material, I think I would love to figure out a way to do, I mean, it seems like very exciting to me, like the prospect of just kind of getting out there and doing it by myself. But I don't know, I can't, I guess, also just, you know, with age and time, etc., like, I can't necessarily imagine myself enjoying doing the whole, like, crashing at, you know, strangers or people's floors. And kind of playing whatever shows. Yeah, that's really tough, because I think, like, maybe it might just depend on the week. But for the most, being able to kind of get so much from what I get of my day job and then leave and still have the energy to go work on, you know, a song or something like that, or, you know, go play shows on the weekends, that's just fine with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like, not to be too repetitive, mm-hmm. but it sounds like what you're saying is there's certain, like, feelings you want to fulfill, or certain,
yeah.
like, you know, you want to be creatively fulfilled.
Yeah.
You know, you want to, like, have a balance to a certain extent. It doesn't really matter what that looks like and what...
Yeah, I was thinking about it even earlier before I came over. I just think, like, I mean, truly one of my biggest fears ever would just be to, like, not be someone that's making things.
Yeah.
And so... However I can, you know, keep that up throughout, I would hope, of a long life, you know, is something I'm trying to figure out. And right now it feels like I am able to do that. So I'm trying to just kind of, like, listen to what's going on around me and keep going. I get so frustrated and so sometimes just sad when I worry that sometimes I'm projecting. But, like, when I see people lose that spirit in themselves of, you know, the creative side, or, like, that kind of, oh, well, I used to, like, play the piano every once in a while, or I used to, you know, draw or anything like that. It, like, hurts me. Like,
yeah.
I feel like sometimes physically
yeah.
To hear that talk. And I guess, you know, who knows? Maybe one day I'll say that too. So, but hopefully not,
yeah.
you know? And so,
like, maybe if you have, like, kids one day, you might have, like, a break.
Yeah. 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 But, like, I can't imagine, you know, not having that part of my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about the music that you're creating now. And I know there's a lot in store for 2019. This will probably go up early February.
Cool.
So.
Cool. So, yeah, I have primarily played in band formats for, I think, over a decade now.
What was your, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you, but what was your first band
for you? So my first band ever was in high school, and we were called Legends of a Hidden Temple, named after the Nickelodeon show. It's actually funny because I just had friends in town. They all formed, like, some of my oldest best friends, like, they all had this other band that I wanted to be in so badly, but they had already, like, filled all the spots. So then I started this one, and, like, we clearly were not as good, you know, but I was just, like, willing. But I think about this a lot, though, but I was willing to work so hard, like, to be as good. Like, I don't think we ever were, but I just remember, like, that was the first experience where I was like, I will show up at my buddy's house that lives up the street. That was our drummer, one of my oldest friends, John. Every single Wednesday, go home immediately, grab my guitar, and, like, literally run, like, up a hill to his house just so we could, like, play music. So I feel like that experience was, like, pretty formative, because I think maybe more than talent, maybe a little bit, I've had more, like the work ethic, you know, part is, I think, what's kind of plays to my strengths a little bit more. But anyway, that was my first band ever. And then in college, I kind of did the typical, like, I can't, you know, play electric guitar in my dorm room. So I got an acoustic guitar and was getting more into Neil Young and classic rock and all that. That's when I met Kelly, who was the singer of Secret Mountains. So that kind of started as, like, a folky right around the old Juno soundtrack period of indie music. So we kind of got lumped into that pocket. And then, yeah, that expanded to be Secret Mountains, which was like my first, not real band, but I guess, you know, a band that put out multiple EPs in the full length and toured the country, and, you know, played festivals and stuff like that. Then in New York, obviously for the past, you know, few years, I've been working with Justin on NASA. The stuff that I am doing now, I guess it's kind of like a culmination of all truly being able to tap into like all of the things that I personally love about music, access those things, and then also I think it's very healthy for me to be working on music by myself right now, because I do think to some degree in Secret Mountains and NASA, and maybe I've always kind of said like I'll have an idea of my own, but I'm almost hearing someone else sing it or needing someone else to help me execute it.
Yeah.
And I think right now I'm like actively saying that like, no, like I can do that for myself. And that's like a pretty freeing experience. It's really hard because I also feel like I'm also leaning on just my own talents, you know?
But, scarier for sure.
Right? Yeah. But certainly so far has been like an extremely, I think, worthwhile cause, and I would feel very silly if I didn't mention, I think, Sunny here too, because I think she's been someone that for all of the bands, you know, I've been, and she's like, oh, like, you know, like you like wrote that song, or like you're the one that, you know, like
had... she is really good at doing that for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like, I mean, that is obviously one of the many reasons I married her. But, you know, she kind of knew it, and she, you know, kind of has given me the encouragement and kind of nudged me along to just start working on some of this stuff on my own. And pretty much since moving into the apartment where we are now in Portland, where we have a little unfinished basement, where I have finally, like, the room to work on things on my own, and I have, you know, I've never even had, like, the program that I needed to record music, or a mic, or the cables, or the interface. Like, I never had any of that because I always relied on other people. So again, this is like another, like, I have the tools now. It forces me to learn, you know, how to record my own music, which I think is super important these days as a songwriter too, even just to be able to make demos and stuff like that. So I was like starting to tinker around a little bit. Actually, I mean, to some degree, thanks to you, I knew about, you know, a residency out on the coast in Washington, because of the Piney Wood Atlas, which, again, thanks, Shannon, for, you know, just like,
thanks to Piney Wood.
I mean, that's like a really incredible resource for, you know, people looking to,
I think, Jude, for like nothing other than to like be helpful. Like, they don't make any money from that.
And I definitely, thinking about an artist residency, I definitely had the questions of, what is that? How do you do that? Is that really just for people who have already written 10 records and are deep into their, you know, whatever? Or is it just for fine artists? I kind of, you know, all of a sudden I applied for a residency at a place called the Sou'wester Lodge, which is out on the coast in Washington, in a little small town called Seaview, which is also the most adorable town ever, with like the best dive bar across the street called the Lamplighter, and I loved that. But they have turned all of these old Airstream trailers into like kind of redone places that people can stay, and there's like a main lodge area, and one of the trailers is like an old Ford motorhome that they had different musicians come and rig it up as like kind of a mobile recording studio. I mean, I guess the actual vehicle stays parked there, but you know, they've built in multiple amps in there. They've got a record player. They've got a piano in there, and like all of these, you know, a four track you can record with, and just like everything you would need. So I literally, back in March, I stayed in that Ford trailer for 4 days and attempted to write a bunch of songs. And that was kind of, in general, that really was
4 days.
Yeah, I think I stayed there for 4 days, and maybe on the fourth or the fifth I played what I wrote in their main lodge area. I just thought that would be a really nice way to kind of cap the experience, as well as invite some other musicians from Portland to come out. I mean, to be honest, that was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had, like, period, you know, just to
That's pretty recently, right?
This winter, or this past winter. Again, just an experience that I never thought I would have, but that I decided to go for. You know, I also kind of presented it in a way that, like, these would be, like, my point for the residency, I would be writing and demoing material for, like, a eventual release. And most of the songs that are coming out on an EP that I'm putting out on January 25th of 2019 came from that experience, or at least the initial thoughts came from that experience. And I guess I've been, you know, I think we kind of qualified some of NASA's music as this too, but I'm calling them kind of ambient folk songs. Uh-huh. Definitely feel like as I get, I don't know if it's age or what, but, you know, just kind of like music that can kind of blend in with the natural world a little bit more is kind of really what I like.
I think part of that's from being out here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, it's like, I think it has continued. I think I was always attracted to that. Mm-hmm. And I think now that I live here, I think that totally rings true even more. I remember getting to see, people go so nuts about Brian Eno. I don't really know his music. I still don't necessarily have a sense of, like, necessarily why people go as crazy for him as they do. However, I went when I was still living in New York, still working at MTV, to see him talk as part of, like, the Red Bull Music Academy series. Mm-hmm. And he talks about this, a time that he was, like, very sick at home in bed as a kid. And it was, you know, the rain is coming down. You know, all he had to do was, like, listen to music, right? That was kind of, like, how he was passing the time. And he had a friend come over one day. It was starting to rain really hard and be so loud. And the friend obviously immediately went to go turn up the music to be like, oh, like, you got to be able to hear this. You know, or like, here comes this cool part. And Brian, you know, was like, no, like, I like the way it sounds, like, with the rain. Mm. As kind of simple as a concept of it is, I was like, yes, that's, like, what I really like. And almost, not necessarily background music, but music that can be, even if you're not, like, always so fully focused on, you can still take something from it.
Dude, the day I turned 30, I couldn't do something and listen to music with lyrics. And even any music's hard for me now. But, like, I can't. I used to write and listen to music all the time.
So I actually have been talking about this quite a lot recently. I mean, I used to, you know, be able to fall asleep, like, in high school with headphones on, listening to whatever, like, heavy punk music I was listening, or, like, you know, screamo or whatever, and just be able to knock out. And yeah, I used to be able to read with headphones on, with music, with lyrics, you know. And I can't do any of that. And now I think also I just, on the subway too, like, in New York, there's this kind of, like, there is, like, those very incredible moments where you're like, I don't know, maybe you're a little bit stoned, but not too stoned, and you've got your headphones on, and you're in New York, and you're on the subway, and you're looking at all the different types of people, and you're like, oh my god, and it's, like, the perfect song, and you're taking it all in. Like, that is, like, a real, very special New York moment. But even after a while on the subway, like, I was just like, I can't even, like, enjoy music right now, because everything was just, like, too crammed and rushed, and I kind of felt like once I just started not listening to music to commute, like, even on the train.
I could never do that. I think I went back now, maybe, but then I, like, needed music, because it was, like...
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Like, I felt like I just couldn't... I needed, like, my quiet, you know, moments. It is kind of interesting now, how sometimes now I'll get in a car and, like, not necessarily always have to, like, have music on. Like, sometimes just as pleasing for me to, like, just sit, you know?
My big drives, I've never been good at, like, driving without music. Mm-hmm. Like, my brain just goes wild, and I really should embrace it more, because I'm usually like, nope, don't want to think that thought.
Yeah.
I've got to put music on.
I'm kind of back to driving again, obviously, more often out here. And, you know, I can either take the bus or drive to work. And I did kind of forget, though, how special that moment of, like, just you in your own vehicle, that commute to work can be, where, like, you can just have the song on that you want to hear and not be dealing with, you know, a million other people. Or even if I am just sitting in silence, like, just that kind of quiet alone time is, like, so nice. I also think part of that is, I don't know if I'm becoming less extroverted as time goes on. It certainly feels that way, where, like, I don't necessarily get as much of a power up these days from being around people or being in big social scenarios. So I think I'm almost a little bit more introverted extrovert instead of like just extroverted.
Okay, you were historically pretty.
Yeah, yeah, where I feel like I just needed to do things all the time and go to every show and be at every event and didn't really feel tired by that, you know? Yeah. Like I almost feel like I got more energy from doing that. And this is also something that, you know, I talk about in that article as well too, though, is like then I definitely, I had no idea how to like stop.
Right.
You know, or yeah. like say no to an invitation.
And that's also New York culture.
Yeah.
That's like one of the reasons why I left.
And yeah,
like,
yeah.
Four birthday parties, like yep. a going away party for yep. someone I don't even know, like 10 shows. Got burnt out.
Yeah, and I do think once I started to learn that skill, I think maybe it lined up to me starting to be a little bit more comfortable with myself too, yeah. or at least like starting to challenge my own beliefs about myself. That's when I also think I was able to like, okay, like maybe I'm saying no, but it actually might then equate to really, like truly deeply focusing on a piece of writing or music, which then in turn was just as rewarding, if not more. And I think maybe that's why I'm so driven by that kind of balance of time, because I know that that's like a feeling that I want to get to as well, and I have to actively carve out that time for myself, and so when I have it, I feel like I really kind of like honor it and try to reward myself for, you know, yeah. for that. But it almost feels like it's a reward to have that time to create, which I think helps me. I don't think that would work for everyone,
yeah.
But that's how I kind of operate. Yeah.
When you mentioned the 4 days
yeah.
at the Sue Western, I was thinking about it because I think one of my biggest creative flaws is that I don't give myself a chunk of time to work on one
yeah.
thing. I'm constantly working on 20 things. And yeah. if I'm not, I'm like, or at least three.
Yeah.
And if I'm not, I'm like stressing. And it's always, if I'm doing something that doesn't make money, I'm stressing out about the fact that I'm not working on client work or not like doing business development or wherever, depending on where I'm at. And I think it's probably all based on in fear that like of whatever that thing I'm gonna sit down and focus on for 3 days
yeah
isn't gonna be successful in whatever way. I don't know if that's what's happening or if it's like just I'm worried about making money. I'm not I always admire people who can sit down and like work on a book for 2 weeks or like work on music for 4 days.
Yeah, I mean that in those 4 days there, you know, again, it happened to line up with like my winter break or spring break from teaching.
Right.
So it was almost like it was kind of like a gift in a way to myself, even to like go, you know, do yeah. that. And you're also
getting paid still.
Yeah. So it kind of like was like, you know, it made a lot of sense. And again, that was maybe one of the, I think that's like a really nice example of how the timing and the schedule of teaching, et cetera, can then help support.
Yeah.
These other like yeah. things. Yeah, but for the most part, I don't always have that kind of like set chunk of time. I do think though that something that really helps is just like putting something on the books, even if I'm not ready for it, like yeah. recording time. Or when I, you know, said I was going to do that residency, I was like, I knew for a fact that I was like, there's no way I'm just going to show up there and magically have songs. So it made me like be like, wait, I need to like dust off some of these pedals or get my guitar, you know, set up and like at least start to come up with like a couple of pre-ideas to take there, because I knew there was no way I was just gonna like magically.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure, right?
Yeah,
like sitting there, also oh you're not God. With your wife or your cat.
Yeah,
you're
yeah, like yeah.
sitting in an empty trailer or whatever, filled with the recording equipment.
Yeah, and like luckily, you know, that was like very, it was great because it was just rain. It rained the whole time. I would just kind of take a break, go into the main room to grab coffee or hang out by their little fireplace, and they had like a record player. You could just like go browse records in there and put something that's on, nice. Which I really loved.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm so highly distractible, and I'm like, oh, I could just like go to the bar, you know, or like, but I was like, no, like I tried to remind myself like I was there for a reason. And
I'm super distracted by nature. Like I went, yeah. so I was just in Encinitas like, yeah. on my own personal retreat, yeah. and I'm like, I'm gonna go there and I'm like edit all the episodes I've recorded. Edited like four.
Yeah.
But I was like, I'm near the ocean. Must sit on beach mm-hmm, and read. Mm-hmm. Like it wasn't even that nice out, but I was still like.
I know, and it's like I don't know. I find all of that like very interesting too. Just like the reasons why we like kind of guilt ourselves into that kind of stuff. I mean, I feel crazy when I don't have another show lined up or another writing assignment or, you know, and I don't know. I can't tell if that's a good or a bad thing. Like, I think it must be a little bit good because I'm, like, wanting to keep going. But at the same time, like, it's like I shouldn't be, like, punishing myself for this, you know? Yeah. So I totally relate to that. I don't know. I think, I guess, another fear is that, like, I definitely come more from the school of thought of, like, it's just so important to finish things and, like, get things done. But I worry about rushing or that I would like to push myself sometimes to just say that, like, things can just be not finished and that's okay. Yeah. And kind of just move on.
Yeah. I want to ask you more about the music writing, but that also reminds me of the whole singles club thing. And I had, like, part of that guide that really resonated with me was, like, coming to grips with the fact that that wasn't really working. And I think, like, or not working, but it wasn't sustainable. And it was. And then did you put, like, a hard end to it? Or was it more, did you let it fizzle like I let a song today fizzle?
It's a good question.
Like, if you go to the website right now, is it?
I actually think Chris, who is my best friend, who lives in New York, who was the drummer of Secret Mountains, who is my partner in the Singles Club project. We did two years of it, so 8 releases, because we were putting out a 7-inch every quarter.
And they were ones that you had specifically pressed?
Yeah, so it was like a new song from an artist, ideally with, or, you know, with the vision that that would, you know, not be a song that would be found anywhere else. And, like, the B-side to that single was, like, a spoken word interview. Mm-hmm. I always find hearing an artist, like, speak is very interesting. Chris and I both, that was, like, a pride point of the project, I think, just because we both, I think, really enjoyed it. Like, whoa, that's what that person sounds like when they're just hanging out, you know? We definitely, you know, ran ourselves pretty ragged. That was, again, when I was teaching, going to school. Chris is always doing, I don't know how he does as much as he does, you know, between side projects, etc. But I think maybe halfway through the second year of it, it was just like, we're either gonna, like, significantly have to change up how we are operating or how often we're releasing music or the format, or start to pare down the number of kind of online features that we're doing with each release, because, like, every release, right, we were working with different writers and photographers on all of this, like, extra content. So it was like this.
It was very well done.
Thanks.
It seemed like a
big
production.
Yeah, it was. It was, I mean, to be honest, it was a pretty massive production, I think, looking back now. Necessarily don't even think sometimes we realized how big of a production it was. And yeah, like, about halfway through that second year of it, I think we both just kind of knew, like, this isn't sustainable. You know, selling records is hard. Selling 7-inch records is even harder. Selling subscriptions to things might even be harder than that. But we kind of, like, feel like at that point it was really interesting. I felt like there were so many labels that were starting to do a subscription series. It kind of felt like it became this, like, hot new way for labels to get out there. And so we kind of felt like we were, in, like, almost, like, a little bit ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And that felt really exciting to us, I think. Because we kind of launched, like, right before some of that started to happen. But
you're before Vinyl Me Please, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, or
and that's huge.
Yeah. Or it was maybe around the same time, because, I mean, those guys, you know, we would talk to, and so it was, it felt very exciting. And again, stopping that was super hard, because I think we did both love it.
Was that breaking even or making any money?
No.
Costing more than it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
I think that's a good, makes it a little bit easier to how much more.
And, like, I also, I think part of it too was, like, I think it also is somewhat of testament to, like, Chris and mine's friendship too, that we were both able to just be like, let's not, like, kill ourselves and, you know, like, just kind of be honest with each other. And that was kind of, I think we were both, especially myself during that project, was building the skill set of saying when I, like, didn't like something, or being direct even with someone that I felt really close with, and saying, like, no, like, you need to, you know, do this like this way, or, like, change this. And I know that Chris could do that with me too. And also recognize when you're asking too much of someone who is involved in so many, you know, other things, and is also the one that's putting in the majority of the funding into said project. But I think we were both developing a lot of, like, I was developing some editorial kind of skills because I was the one kind of getting stories from other writers and acting more as an editor role, which I had never done. Chris was flexing all of his design muscles. I was doing all of my, a continuation of the things that I've always done for my own bands, which is PR and outreach and even trying to secure like sponsorships and things like that, setting up events, record fairs, you know, all of the stuff that I had done for a long time. I really felt like I got to like do on in a different level. It gave me, you know, definitely a more appreciation and understanding of just how a label actually works instead of thinking I knew, or just a business in general. Anyway, so, you know, when you go to the website now, I actually think Chris just like shut down the store, so I don't think people can purchase anything. But for a while, we just had it up that you could still, you know, read every issue, you know, buy the one-off 7 inches.
That he had to then ship.
Everything was housed out of his apartment in Brooklyn, you know, so up 6 flight of stairs. Oh my god, I remember sometimes like loading records like in and out of that. Those stairs are insane. Chris, if you are listening eventually to this, like I might not ever walk up those stairs again. But the roof is really cool. But yeah, I don't know. And sometimes I forget that project's right. It still lives on. It still exists in the internet, but I don't have to like talk about it. I don't have to like, but I kind of like knowing that it just is there and exists. And if someone stumbles across that site, that's, you know, that's fantastic.
And if you're like pursuing a career in the music industry, you probably wouldn't be forgetting about it, and it'd probably be pretty much your resume, right?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, I think, to be honest, like, I don't know, I'm always thinking about potentially, like, other jobs I could have, too, even though I do love teaching so much, or that, but, you know, in general, yeah, it's such a strong thing to have on the resume, or to be able to reference for all sorts of projects, just because it did encompass as much, as much as it did. And, of course, for the past however many years that we haven't been doing that, you know, Chris and I constantly, like, text, like, you know, maybe we could, you know, do, like, a covers thing, or, you know, we're always, like, throwing around ideas here and there. Actually, it was really crazy, the Michael Now song that we put out, I was literally watching television the other day, like, a British show on Netflix or something, and that song came on.
No way.
And that was really cool.
So do you not own the rights to that song?
No. So we were, I mean, we were fools in regards to, like, the music then. It's like, we didn't have a contract, we didn't have, nor was any of this really going up digitally. It was like, you were either getting this on vinyl or not. Not because we didn't see value in the digital side, it was just like, we're already doing so much, like, maybe it added to this more of this, like, exclusive thing or whatever. But the really neat part with that Michael tune is that, you know, he kind of eventually said to us, he was in one of my all-time favorite bands with his wife, Whitney, who Secret Mountains would play with a lot in Baltimore. They were called Cotton Jones.
Oh. I did not
Yeah, so that's,
those two together. I did not realize he was.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I still love those records. They're very near and dear to my heart. I think that project ended, and he basically said, he was like, you know, putting out that single kind of gave me this, like, new momentum to keep going, like, just under my own name. That to me, was, like, one of the biggest victories.
Yeah, his solo stuff is great.
Yeah, I'm very interested just in him as a person, as a songwriter, and lucky enough to call him a friend too, because I think he also kind of represents someone that carves their own path and isn't content to just like be defined by one thing he was involved with, or be just like one thing. And I really admire that in an artist. So
yeah, totally. One thing I want to ask you selfishly is, for when you're balancing the freelance writing into all of this, do you have like a set routine for like, and like goals of, okay, I need to write this many pieces, or, and of course it depends on if you, like, if something and got a deadline or whatever, but do you have specific times you sit down to write versus when you write for music, and does that...
Yeah, I think I could use to improve on like some more set like practices or guidelines in regards to like maybe like that day is for writing or that day is for music. That, I don't know, like I'm just kind of thinking out loud, but the writing, like the freelance writing for stories, definitely I try to be a little bit more selective now and make sure that it is something I am like truly interested and passionate about, instead of just feeling like, I have to do another story because, like, this is how I'm making a living.
Right.
So I think, again, in that way, that's, like, another way that it actually, the balance there really supports it, because it actually allows me, I felt like I did enough writing for free for a while that then I kind of, maybe a year or 2 years ago, set the precedent for myself of, like, not writing for free anymore, which also simultaneously meant, like, maybe not writing for sites that, like, I still really love, but they just wasn't a budget for.
Yeah.
So now I do try to make it, again, the thing there is more like, am I really interested and excited about this? You know, is there actually some kind of budget for this? And, you know, does it fit in with the rest of my life? And I think it's a kind of just, I try to just do pitches in batches. So I will have 3 or 4 ideas that I will think about the various publications I've written for that I think could be good fits, kind of do a few different rounds. Ideally, for me right now, personally, a best case scenario is when 1 or 2 of those ideas, like, lands at a time, because more than that would not be feasible for me.
Okay. How long do you spend on those pieces, do you think?
It depends on how much research is required. I definitely enjoy the doing my homework part of it. Reading as many interviews as I can with that person, you know, and articles and so on and so forth. Obviously, it is interesting there to pick up on trends that get recycled, or to realize that some people just have that kind of, I think eventually, right, you... artists just do have, like, the same kind of stories that they spin just in different ways for different interviews. But I would say, you know, maybe it's, like, 1 or 2 days of that research kind of phase, and then depending on the length of the piece, I do try to give myself a block of time during, you know, hours that I normally feel the most kind of awake or most motivated. Usually that's, like, mornings right after exercise. Sometimes, though, that's, like, oh my God, like, I still have this much energy after work, and I just, like, go for it, you know? But then maybe it's, you know, 2 to 3 days of the actual, like, writing of it and organizing of it. I feel like I tried to come up with some highlights and bold things and make some kind of outline in my mind before diving in, which really helps. I'll just kind of make a Google Doc of, like, all of my research. And I definitely spend a good amount of time kind of going back through that and, like, just, like, pulling things out to focus on. And then I'll open up another one, you know, for the actual, like, draft of it. So, yeah, and I don't know. I feel lucky, again, that I've gotten to kind of work on a few things recently with editors that truly, you know, want to, like, make you a better writer, not just be like, oh, great, you turned it in, you know. Yeah, so.
Will is a great editor.
Yeah, phenomenal. Yeah. I mean, her suggestions, yeah, for that article were like, oh, my God. Like,
yeah.
Clearly, I would not have thought of that, or, you know, I totally see, you know, how I can make this stronger. And then I think when you get really good edits, then you push yourself even harder because the bar is set higher. And I think that's kind of ties back to the teaching thing of good teachers set high expectations for kids. They don't just kind of lower it because it's hard or because it's something they're working through. So I think that kind of ties there. Editor that I really admire from Bandcamp is Joseph Keys. I think there was one review of mine that I wrote, like, an album of the day piece, and he basically, you know, my first take of it, he was basically like, this doesn't, like, tell me anything. He was like, this doesn't, you know what I mean? He's like, I don't really know what this sounds like. I think that was, there was a lot of edits for, like, a pretty short, fairly, you know, short-ish review, and I was like, at first I felt like I was, like, kind of, like, defeated, like, whoa, that many edits just for this, you know, thing, or, like, what, you know, and then I was like, no, this, I just love that he did that for me, because I also think it represented, like, the challenge of writing really well, really succinctly, I think is something I'm, like, very interested in, which also then I think ties to why a lot of the songs I'm working on, like, don't have very many lyrics.
I was thinking the last time we did talk about Nassau, you were talking about that you were starting to contribute more, like, vocals and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that included lyrics too, or is this more singing? Has that been a part of the, like, the benefit of solo stuff, or is that something you're still...
I mean, to some degree, I've come kind of full circle because, you know, the earliest songs I wrote in high school and college, I didn't have anyone else to, like, I was just kind of playing acoustic by myself in college. I mean, I played a few shows that were me singing, which I never felt that confident about then. And then therefore, right, then I met Kelly from Secret Mountains, and then it immediately became like, nope, you are the singer, right? Like, I would sing a little. And then when that band really expanded, it was just like, Jeff, you no longer sing. Yeah. You know, like, that is not, you know, like, it was kind of like, and I, like, didn't, like, you know, take any offense to that. And it was around that same time, though. I mean, I think I was, but I was always contributing lyrics. And I was always kind of definitely more in touch with lyrics that, you know, said a lot with a little or just were the same kind of repeated phrase. And that definitely carried into NASA a bit where, yeah, we were coming up with ideas. I was kind of leaning on Justin to execute more of the vocals. And then I definitely wanted to start to push myself to contribute more in that way, just because I think I didn't want to always take that backseat. And I also wanted to figure out how to make it work for myself. So there was, you know, a couple songs on the Heron LP that we put out where I'm singing, one of which, you know, is just me singing or more of my, just like just my vocal. Kind of just like one of those songs that just got like buried into the rest, which I totally get. It's like a, you know, a shorter kind of number.
But which one is it?
It's called Spring. Okay. But I remember doing that and being like, oh, like, kind of like the way my voice sounds, and, you know, like a little bit more of like a confidence kind of boost. And then, you know, at the same time, I'm like, so I've just gotten so into instrumental music and acoustic guitar music that I think when I was approaching some of this solo material, I was curious, like, am I gonna have vocals at all? Am I just gonna make a weirdo whatever experimental record? So I think I've tried to find the balance of it's okay to have both.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I'm at. And my favorite kind of, because I definitely feel like I'm just such an appreciator of like the song, I guess in general, but like, so one of my favorite albums ever of all time is this guy, Ted Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
His, you know, kind of whatever you want to call it, masterpiece of an album just got reissued for this year on Yoga Records, which I'm so excited because
that tribute was so much fun.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Oh, we got to talk about that because I was so unbelievably jealous that you were there. I actually,
it was a really good night.
Yeah, I wrote to the guy about doing one here, so we'll see. But the reason, one of the reasons why that record never got, apparently, and I mean, I didn't really know this part of the history until I got to read all of the liner notes. And, you know, I knew a bit about him and that he was this, like, he was kind of a go-to guy for studio Motown, musician, studio musician for Motown Records.
Incredible people, yeah. I mean, Motown, like, Records.
Yeah, and, like, that the artwork originally was for Jimi Hendrix.
I didn't know that.
And it's funny because now the imagery that was used is actually the artist, like, also had sold the rights to it. So now it's like it wound up being on all of these Journey records. It's like all you can see, like, the comparison. And it's just so funny because, like, Journey, Ted Lucas, very different.
Very different.
Yeah. One of the reasons, apparently, other than Ted Lucas being notoriously difficult to work with.
Really?
I don't know that either. Is that the kind of demo or the album that he submitted that became this private press folk record for so long that now all these people can hear, but was that the album, the A side, is kind of traditional singer songwriter songs. Mm-hmm. And but there's some repetitive lyrics that I really love. It's and very simple, definitely for like songwriter heads, like you know, you will like this calming folk music.
Yeah.
The second side is all instrumentals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for people putting out records back then, I think they were like, no, it's kind of either one or the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of love the idea that you, like, listen to this set of, like, four or five, I forget how many songs are on the A side, turn it over, and then it just becomes this, it still fits, I think, but it just becomes this whole nother thing. And again, I think without maybe me even knowing it, I think that's kind of where I'm at. So, yeah.
I love that you said that about that record, because I gifted it to my dad on iTunes, because he doesn't have a vinyl.
Hell yeah.
And he's a musician.
That's just so funny because my dad would be like, yeah, what is this?
Yeah. Well, I was expecting, I'm like, this is going to be the thing that we can finally, like, meet on.
Nice.
And although, I mean, we love a lot of the same music, yeah. But we also, like, refuse to agree on
things. Yeah, yeah.
So, and I love the first half of that album. I love all of it, mm-hmm. But I love the first half of that album.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's the stuff that got me
right
hooked. Like, yeah.
He was like, I found the second half much more interesting, and then said a bunch of stuff a musician
would
say.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Like, I didn't understand.
Yeah.
But for a second, I'm like, it almost makes me happy I'm not a musician. Just because I'm like, I can just enjoy something at like face value and like not be paying attention. I don't, he said a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought it was interesting that he really liked the second half.
That is super interesting. Yes. And I totally get, right, why like certain. It's
more technical.
Yeah, or why like certain brains would gravitate
more towards
one or the other.
Yeah, because I like the way a song makes me feel. That's like how I judge music.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that, yeah. I would like, there's a, I talked about this for what seems like forever to you now, but like, I've always valued like songs over sounds more. So like the feeling rather than like, oh, that's like the coolest guitar tone. Like sometimes I'm like, oh my God, like I love the way that whatever that sounds, and I want to know what pedal, but like for the most part I am also like gravitating more towards like the feeling.
Yeah like even some like the hard rock stuff, like I love Ty Segall. I'm like a mm-hmm. unabashed Ty Segall mm-hmm. fan, and my friend Pete knows that, and he's like, okay, I'm gonna like put this music on because I need to hear what it is, like you're such a big fan, and he does not listen to that type of music, and it just made me uncomfortable. I'm like, I think it's just I love listening to the shit when I'm on a run or like mm-hmm. I don't know, just need to release. It's not just really casually listening with someone who's never listened to it before.
Yeah, I can imagine how like putting that on for someone that maybe listen doesn't relate. Like
electronic music.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it is funny sharing music in that way with people that like you know there's like that clear divide, and you're just kind of like, I feel a little strange right now.
Yeah.
You probably feel a little strange too. But I don't know. It's cool.
Yeah.
To at least try that with other people instead of assuming, right, that they would never like want to hear it. Or
so you mentioned that the new music mm-hmm. is really tapping things that you love about music.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any of those we haven't already covered? Like, what are those things that it's tapping?
It's clear that like the Ted Lucas thing, that I also have like a mind for, you know, simple songs.
Yeah,
I guess. Yeah, also trying to work like a little bit more with some kind of like intentional focus, but not being like too obsessed with it. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Kind of do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And like go with the flow.
Yeah.
But.
And then a big part, at least for me with this one too, is that I will be giving part of the proceeds from the, because it's coming out on like on digital and cassette, and hoping that some of the proceeds are, I will be giving to an organization here in town called My Voice Music, which mm-hmm. like works with underprivileged kids to develop like confidence and self-esteem through music, and they actually have like their own recording studio. Kids can come and, you know, try different instruments and work on it. So I think maybe it's also that it's tapping into the, again, to the connection of giving back in community. And I am like becoming more of a believer, a really firm believer over time, that if you make art or a song, etc., that like at some point in time, just once, you should try to play it for another person. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a show, it doesn't have to be, you know, but just like once, just like make a gallery on your refrigerator or, you know, like whatever it is, because I think it can help. You know, I'm learning that there's totally just value in making something just for yourself and stuff that you don't have to tweet about or post on Instagram or whatever, but I do think there is such inherent value in like sharing songs with other people, and I don't know, like that's and as cheesy as it sounds, like that's totally just from like, I remember the Wilco song what light it's called, he just says like, you know, if you feel like singing the song and you want other people to sing along, just sing what you feel, don't let other people tell you it's wrong. And I'm just like, I remember hearing it, I'm like, okay, like, yeah. I could try that.
Right, Jeff?
Yeah, like, well, all right, Jeff. Like, and that's also, it's funny, I like just got done reading his book.
Yeah.
I got into the Wilco game late, so Sky Blue Sky is like one of my favorite records ever, which is like later into the Wilco, you know, catalog, and kind of like waiting for the moment in the book where he starts talking about that record. And like, it's like very much at the end where he like mentions it very briefly, where I'm like, there it was. And like, that's kind of, to some degree, that was like his like recovery record from the things that he was struggling with. But I don't know, that record will always mean a lot to me. Yeah.
Wilco, I've been a fan of for like ever. I feel like there's a lot of bands I was like a really big fan of like before they were cool. Mm-hmm. And I just like, I had no one to talk to about that stuff with. So like, I just kept it to myself and then would like kind of forget. Yeah. And then like they would get big and I'm like, oh yeah, I loved that band.
It's so funny because I didn't my older brother was like only listening to like, during my formative years, you know, he was more locked into like Grateful Dead, Fish, Dave Matthews, OAR, Dispatch, Moe.
My brother too.
And I just, at that age, I just wanted nothing to do with any of that. Like, I tried occasionally, you know, and of course now I'm like, oh my God, like my brother had binders full of Live Dead albums that I could have right now, because of course now I love it. But I feel like I had to like find my own way to that music. But yeah, a lot of the stuff I, like some of that indie stuff, I did not have someone like an older sibling like showing me that stuff. Yeah. So I feel like I just kind of like missed that window of like, I didn't have people showing me like Wilco or Pavement or, you know, like.
Me either, but somehow I found it. Yeah, I don't know how. Like Napster somehow just knew.
Yeah, see, I feel like I like did not get directed. I just like went heavy on the like emo and punk and hardcore and all that. So
the EP comes out, is it next month? Is it January?
Yeah, January 25th on Driftless Recordings, which is a small label in Los Angeles. Yeah, I'm excited. It's all done and ready, and I'm kind of, you know, already just kind of thinking about what's next.
So I think you already answered this, but I'm gonna make you read it.
Yeah.
Why put out a record on a label if it's something you do for fun? Like, if it's like, something you do on the side, it's not your main gig. Why
at all?
Give it the legs it totally deserves. I'm glad that you're doing it.
Sure.
But like, to a wider distribution, you know, than you would just by like putting it out on Bandcamp yourself.
I think part of it is still like
ingrained.
Maybe.
Like, this is how you do it when you
There's probably like some of that. I think maybe there's like a part of me that feels like somehow that makes it more official or something. But for the most part, I think I was hoping to reach a new audience that I couldn't access beyond my just immediate, you know, kind of personal connections. I really liked the notion of working with a label on the West Coast, and like, but that's not in Portland, because I thought like maybe, I don't know, I've like, with the other bands I was ever in, I never got to like play further than like Austin or Chicago, so I'm very excited to maybe get to go to California and play and stuff like that. But this label, I think, also really does tap into what I was talking about in regards to kind of blending the like kind of like acoustic and electronic elements, or kind of like the blending with natural kind of ambient sounds. I think Patrick, that runs the label, put out my favorite, you know, one of my absolute favorite records of the year, North American. So that's his project.
The North Americans is the name of the group.
Yeah, that's what he records under. And I really loved the model that he kind of used for the album, where he wrote an acoustic guitar record with all of these soundscapes that went around it, and then invited kind of guest performers or vocalists like Hand Habits and Juliana Barwick to kind of be on it. And I was like, oh, that's like so neat. Like, I could do that. Yeah. You know? So it was also really special to me that, you know, they agreed to do it, just because of how much I admire, you know, his artistic kind of vision. And so knowing that someone that I kind of locked up with was very exciting for me as well. Just like aesthetically and, you know, in regards to the diversity of their roster, it just felt like it was a really nice fit.
Nice. That's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm stoked.
I want to talk to you about the Portland music scene, but we can do that like off record.
Sure. Yeah.
Questions and comments.
Yeah.
Two questions I ask everyone. which I keep saying that I'm going to retire one, but I'm going to ask you it anyway because I can't let go of it.
Yep.
What does the word process mean to you?
Process mean... that's a good question. Process would mean, I think, just like working through something deliberately while being okay with like failure or starting over, and using starting over and failure as motivation instead of
quitting.
Yeah.
Sweet. What's something you're excited about today?
Today, I mean, honestly, I was really looking forward to this conversation because I just enjoy doing this in general with people, whether it's for, you know, a podcast or not. These are obviously the things I'm talking about and thinking about all day anyway. I am very thankful to be off work and to have time just to like kind of be home and relaxing and working on, you know, music and exercise. And it's kind of like a quintessential rainy day in Portland. Yeah. And so, yeah, just like coffee.
That's actually, by the way, I'm notorious for saying last question and asking people more questions. That's what I do.
Yeah.
And one band be like, are you even recording?
I'll go all day.
So. Yeah. I feel like you and Sunny as partners, you're both also so creative. And we've had entire episodes with like creative couples and how that whole thing works. And sometimes doesn't, depending on the couple. But I feel like you guys have like a good setup where you both like to work a bit on the weekends on stuff. And like, I don't know, this is all from social media. And like, knowing you guys level I do.
Yeah.
But yeah, do you think that's like a part of the whole thing? Just like having a partner who's also someone who likes to put out creative work and even in their free time?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, it is largely through watching Sunny become a full-time freelance illustrator that I recognized, you know, the many processes that I needed to put in place for myself in order to work in a way that actually produced, you know, results and simultaneously worked in like a meaningful way, because I feel like she does nothing if it's not her like absolute kind of best foot forward, and I really admire her for that. Yeah, I mean, we've said it before. I love that, you know, we can show each other an email to read before we send something off, or, you know, I'll proof just like the text on an illustration, you know, that she's working on, or, you know, obviously she's like the first person I'm probably showing music to, and like, Sunny's got a great ear for that, and I'm biased, but like, I feel like if she's like, yo, this sucks, like, I'm like, all right, yo, this sucks.
You know, my favorite things about Sunny is that she owns her opinions. She's like, no, that's bullshit, or no, that's bad, or like...
Yeah, I think other people like take to that, and clearly I have. That's certainly a skill also that like she's really helped me kind of grow and improve on, is just like the going with something and owning it and, you know, sticking to it. Even if it's like scary or not something you're used to. We're so lucky that schedule wise, you know, certain days of teaching, you know, I can be done, you know, by a really decent hour. And if she's not totally slammed and working into the evening, and I know that she gets most of her like best work out, like when she's like up and at them early, you know, we can still go do something and either go to a show and like it's not like devastating because we're both like, you know what I mean, like we still can like have the energy to like be with one another and like be somewhat present instead of like just like, oh, I'm so tired
because
I stayed at the office till 8 or you know, for no reason. So yeah, our schedules line up very nicely, and then I know it would be really hard if, you know, she had a different setup. You know, if it didn't line up with her vacation, it would make things so hard. But the fact that, like, we can always kind of work together in that way is really nice.
Okay, final question for sure this time. What role, if any, does running play? Things you're, like, I don't know how far fast you run, but just, like, the volume at which you run, the frequency
is
impressive.
I'm glad you asked that. In general, frequent exercise has been, I'd probably go ahead and call it life-saving in regards to my own, you know, mental health. Mm-hmm. It's funny, there's like my driver's license is still a New York license, and I just like, I mean, truth be told, like I just do not like the way I look in it.
Okay.
I think there was a certain point living in New York where I was feeling just very poor about my own body image in general. And I started going to spin class at the YMCA. And then from there, I just kind of like got into running, and in New York, like kind of did like a few 5Ks and then built my way up and eventually, you know, worked up to a half marathon, which was awesome. I love the races are so great as something to have to look forward to, which I think is so important for mental health.
Yeah.
In regards to doing it with a group, especially something like in New York where you're doing it with potentially thousands upon thousands of other people and everyone's cheering you on, you know, across
the...
That's
like my worst nightmare,
though. I mean, running like... a giant group of people. Yeah, like, you know, but the, you know, the fact you're, like, looking around, like, everyone's just, like, clapping you along. You're like, wow, this is, you know, I feel, like, of course that's gonna, like, feel good, you know? And I, you know, it's funny with all that stuff, like... A lot of people will ask me, well, what's your best time, or and like sometimes I don't even know because I'm not really truly ever doing it for a time. I'm just doing it because it feels good and helps me.
Yeah.
Out here, when we first went out here, I did a race on the coast, which was very nice, which like was so much cooler than New York because instead of running on the, you know, city streets, I was literally running through like cow pastures and like farmlands, you know, and I was like, this is like,
instead of exhaust to the like
fresh
air,
so that was like very special. And then a buddy of mine that I was introduced to through Sunny, we've been kind of making it like a regular thing to like on Sundays go to Forest Park and go running. And there hasn't been one day where I haven't been in that park, and still, you know, a year and a half of living here, that I'm just like, holy shit, like this is like a real place in my city, yeah. You know? So yeah, then it really hits a lot of like, you know, obviously there's so many studies about the benefits of, right, of exercise and nature. Yeah. So when you're hitting both of them, it's like, it feels good.
Cool. Well, thank you.
Yeah, of course. That was fantastic.